Hello everyone and welcome to History in Technicolor. This is David and...
This is Wolf.
We're going to talk today about...
A Bridge Too Far.
And the person that's going to talk about the Bridge Too Far is... You.
Yes. On, thank you, David.
Come on, you.
Wonderful introduction. A Bridge Too Far, the 1977 movie, focuses on the 1944 Allied engagement, Operation Market Garden, whereby 35,000 men were flown behind enemy lines, dropped into the German-occupied Netherlands. Their mission was to capture a series of bridges over the Rhine that would help them secure a vital link to Germany and hopefully speed up the resolution of the war. The key bridge in all of this is Arnhem Bridge.
Right. Is that a little bit too far, that bridge?
It's one bridge too far.
Is it?
Yes, right. One. The film is based on the book written by Cornelius Ryan, who was a great military historian and a war correspondent. His previous work led to the film The Longest Day. His goal was always to tell the most complete story, and he conducted thousands of interviews from people on all sides of each conflict. So he had a lot of information. It was very dense.
I've read a couple of books by Cornelius Ryan and watched that other movie.
The Longest Day?
The Longest Day. And The Longest Book. Oh, no, it wasn't called that. But it was quite long.
Anyway, very long. Why have I selected this movie,
Why have you selected this movie?
I've selected this film because... It is made by the legendary Richard Attenborough.
Right, legendary.
Who we've already talked about before.
Dear Dickie.
And I love him.
You're thinking of Miracle on 34th Street? Is it 34th Street?
And Jurassic Park. He's cute in every movie.
Is
except
he cute,
maybe
movie?
Not 10 Wellington Place, but
oh,
I will...
Oh, yes, he's not yes. in that. Or what's the one where he's...
Brighton Rock.
He's not nice in that one either.
Nope, but he's still kind of cute.
Yeah, Dear Dickie.
It contains one of the greatest casts ever assembled.
It is pretty stellar, isn't it? It was amazing. You keep watching these guys come out. You think, well, no. Is that? No. Oh, you know what I mean?
Before we do anything else, can you think of a film which has a better cast?
Right.
Also considering the time, how big they were as stars.
Okay, I really want to say yes, of course I can, but just because, you know, that's my nature. So I'm going to think of Alan Bennett. But no, it's astounding.
I actually thought you might raise The Longest Day, because obviously it's...
Right.
Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, Robert Mitchum, Henry Fonda.
Jimmy Stewart. And of course, any film with Jimmy Stewart is immediately
yes.
superb.
You know. He's wonderful. But anyway, if anybody knows out there a film that has a better cast overall than A Bridge Too Far, then please let us know.
It is pretty stellar, isn't it?
The film is exciting, and it's a very detailed study of a fascinating and disastrous part of World War II. I have very fond memories of being captivated by this film, and have long wanted to visit Arnhem, Nijmegen, and other locations in real life. It's also written by William Goldman, who is one of the most respected screenwriters ever, and who won two Oscars for writing
right.
All the President's Men and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
yep.
Kid. Another of my... Is that historical? Can we make that historical?
We can, sure.
Sundrops, no, not Sundrops. Raindrops, whatever.
It sounds like you love the film.
I do love it.
But from studying screenwriting, his work, his books are referenced... heavily.
Right.
So he's a pretty established voice in that field. Okay. How do we get here? Because I thought this was quite interesting. So the war movies that we all love and know really kicked off in sort of the 50s and the 60s when they were making roughly sort of 200 World War II movies per year. Per decade. Let's make that clear. Per decade. Okay. So you kind of have the Cruel Sea and the Dam Busters in 53, 54. And then you move up to Bridge on the River Kwai, which I think is 58, which won Best Film at the Oscars. Some critics believe that Bridge on the River Kwai kind of changed war films as it introduced a depth and complexity to them. Their views and their characters, I was just talking about this the other day, the film stands out in my mind as being maybe even slightly controversial in terms of how it approaches our memories of the war. So it's a really interesting one to look at. And maybe for a future day.
Yeah, indeed. And The Cruel Sea. Love that movie.
I love that film.
Yeah.
So then in 1962, the epic docudrama The Longest Day is released. Okay, as we've already mentioned, which created another milestone in the genre and kind of paved the way for future epic documentary-style dramas that look to explore the factual side of the war and all its intricate details and all the battle plans and everything. The producer of The Longest Day then went on to set up the American-Japanese co-production of Tora, Tora, Tora in 1970, which is interesting because obviously they're combined with the Japanese to deliver a kind of a joint view of that conflict from both sides. Mm. It's no longer this perhaps propaganda-style movie or one where it's just reinforcing nationalism. They're really just trying to examine history at this point. And I think this is kind of how we get to the point where A Bridge Too Far arrives in 1977. But it's also interesting that it comes sort of 1 year before Apocalypse Now. And then you have this kind of influx of Vietnam movies. And over the next 10 years, you get Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, etc., Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
And those kind of really bring in a kind of a new era to kind of war films. Enjoyment.
Enjoyment level.
So okay. In a second, I'm going to ask you what you thought.
Right, I'm preparing myself to be asked.
But I think it's just worth noting, the cast is truly wonderful.
Cast is truly wonderful.
Minus Gene Hackman's Polish accent.
And Gene Hackman.
It's not a great Polish accent.
It's not a great Polish accent. Also, he's an annoying character. Although I feel a bit guilty about that. Should I talk about that now or leave that? I'll leave that until later. Well, you can ask him about it later.
Well, he's a little bit historically accurate.
He is. Well, the thing is about him, okay, I'll tell you, historically, he sounds like he was very badly treated. You know, dragged into this battle that wasn't necessarily his, and then the only guy who was prosecuted, which is, you know, incredibly unfair. On the other hand, in the film, Gene Hackman never really says what his objections to the operation are. So you see, he's being all sort of passive aggressive and sort of, this isn't going to work, without saying, well, the problem is A, B, and C, so why don't we do D, E, and F? So I found him a little bit annoying in the film, while accepting that historically he got a pretty bad deal.
Did you notice?
Does that make him any better?
Well, I don't know. I'm just going to. While we're talking about it, did you notice that Dirk Bogarde actually doesn't even give him a command? He completely ignores him in the room, has no respect for him at all, and then afterwards, like, oh, I'm sorry, did I forget you? You're doing this part of the mission.
Yeah. And that's what the rubric about him being prosecuted was, that, okay, somebody needs to get carry the can for this. Who's the foreigner? The Pole. Let's do him. So, place that whole
We'll come back to this later, but yeah. I do think it's interesting. Yes. But it's worth noting that everyone's brilliant, but that accent is not.
Indeed. Actually, there's one other guy who isn't brilliant.
Oh, you don't like Ryan O'Neill?
I really don't like Ryan O'Neill. I mean, you know, in Love Story, I can remember my sister weeping copious tears and my mother, you know, doing the same. But he's a bit rubbish in this, isn't he? Looks like he's reading a card. We can't get across the river. Shall we do? But he's the only one.
After you told me it is a little bit hard to watch it, I will admit that. The battle scenes are spectacular. Truly incredible to watch. And the feat that they're even filmed and made is quite incredible. There are lots of really nice human details, which I really enjoy, that kind of still break up the kind of never-ending war scenes. Decent mix of humour, particularly British humour. Lots of tea and biscuits.
Yeah, and lots of Monty Python sketches then, no?
You have... The tea and biscuits every 5 or 10 minutes, and it's wonderful.
There is a nasty moment there, isn't there, where they're stuck. The column is stuck, isn't it? The tanks, and they're brewing up. And the guy comes along to an American guy and comes along to them and says, you know, what are you doing? And actually, there's a perfectly reasonable explanation, which is that they cannot go down until the infantry arrives. Otherwise, they'll be blown to smithereens by the artillery. But it is kind of rather presented as a classic Americans get on, do it, you know, and British going to have a cup of tea before they bother to do anything.
Did you notice when Sean Connery has a cup of tea, it cuts to the Germans and they're also having a cup of tea?
No, I did not notice that.
Straight after, one scene to the next.
But what kind of tea were they drinking, the Germans? Do they have the same sort of
brand? It was in a little China cup.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
It was, I loved it. I think the film is very exciting, particularly early on. To me, it feels like a heist movie. You've got all...
Really?
You know why? Because you've got all the build-up. Okay, so there's loads of tension being created. You see the tanks quite early on, so you're really aware that they're heading into doom, but obviously they're not aware of it. And they're having all these secret meetings, and they're planning, and they're plotting, they're organising the plan, you learn every detail of the plan. It's like we're getting ready for a bank robbery, where you know all the details. So you know if you need a bank robbery, you have to know who's going in what door, who's got what role, who's carrying what, where each person has to be.
And actually,
so that you notice when it goes wrong.
True, and actually I know this now because I watched, you know, the greatest critic in world criticism, Mark Kermode, doing a How Do You Make a Heist music. Have you seen this?
Yes, it was very good.
Very good, yeah.
But do you see what I mean?
Now,
when you think about it, that first
absolutely
hour...
True. Good point.
It's pretty good. And that's when you get a lot of the humour coming in, and I think it's just really enjoyable.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Does the film lose its way? Probably. It's
just outside Doom.
It drags on quite a bit because it is very, very long. There are too many characters, and even with the stars, I know that kind of is designed to make it a little bit easier to track people, but I still forget who's working in, like, what unit, where they are,
yeah,
and what problem is kind of that each person is dealing with. I'll just kind of notice, we're back with Sean Connery, but I won't really know, like, what he's doing in the battle at this point, like, where he's got to go, yeah, and then it'll be James Caan, and I'm like, wait, what's he doing? and then you just have to kind of watch them just doing it and just accept that you've lost track.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, for my two penneth, I went through a kind of process with this movie, and then I talked to you afterwards briefly, and I realised that, you know, I was just wrong in every way, and I went outside and beat myself with a birch twig, and then it was fine.
Are there any birch twigs left in your garden? Well, I'm pretty sure you've thrashed them all.
This song's had the ashes. But essentially, it was really, really long, and actually, you don't get to love anybody. You know, you don't get to identify with anybody. It is kind of like a documentary. And I got lost as well. There are a couple of battles that you begin to focus on, aren't there? The one with Hopkins.
Yes, and so Anthony Hopkins is on Arnhem Bridge.
And that is you a remember one. A little bit, because you get the nice bit with the bloke with the brolly.
Yes.
Which is quite fun. And there's a little bit of human interaction there that makes it work.
And the bit when the German comes over the bridge with the white flag. And
very
it's like,
good.
Would you like to surrender? And they're like, I'm sorry, we can't accept your surrender.
Because we haven't got room for all the prisoners. Nice touch. Yes, that was a nice touch. That was, yeah, there was just a little bit of humour in the movie saying that was good. Once I realised that what I was seeing was a documentary recreation of the war, then I begin to admire it more. Couldn't love it because I didn't feel engaged with the characters. And also, I was aware that I was being told that this was a great screw-up. But so there was a kind of, you know, I'm watching it for the good of my soul. But the battle scenes are amazing. And you really get to, if you want to study, like The Longest Day, if you want to study what happened, this is a brilliant way into it. You know, for use in schools, whatever. Fantastic. And yes, and the actors are brilliant. So I felt similar to
you. Yeah, when I watched it when I was, I don't know, 14, 15, I was captivated.
Yeah.
Honestly, right now I get a little bit bored at times, but I wasn't at all there.
Yeah,
I wanted to see every single scene, like, what happens next? What goes wrong? Like, how do these people get to each other?
Yeah.
It was...
And Doug, who was your favourite character?
I mean, it's...
Film-wise, you know...
It's got to be Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
It's hard not to be Sean Connery. Elliot Gould is phenomenal.
Elliot Gould is very good. Big cigar-chewing guy.
When he appears and he's running and the cigar's in his mouth, it's incredible.
The way he shouts
at everybody, he has a presence which is
I'm going to go for different choices. I'm going to go for Robert Redford because of his jaws. I mean, how does he do that thing with his jaw? You know, he kind of crunches it, doesn't he? And he moves it from left to right. What is Robert Redford's greatest ever movie? You've got 3 seconds.
Well,
three.
You've already two, said Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
one.
Kid.
Not his
I love
movie.
The Sting.
Sting. Either The Sting or The Natural, isn't it? One of the two. You're going to go for Sting.
Well, I just really like The Sting.
I love The Sting too. So we'll say The Sting. We're on the same page. So Robert Redford, because he's Robert Redford. But actually, Dirk Bogarde. It's a much underrated actor, is he not? I mean, he is the epitome of upper-class slime. Not slime, that's too strong. Upper-class... officer class incompetence and lack of self-awareness and lack of willingness to accept that they've messed up.
He fought in the war as well.
He did, and apparently it was all about champagne. And
yes.
So, but I thought he was brilliant. I mean, he absolutely captured the essence of, I think, the filmmaker's view of why the whole thing went wrong, an inability to look reality in the face.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Interesting, Mr. Bond. Oh, Michael Caine, come on. He's
Michael
the best
Caine's
thing in
wonderful.
Any movie in the world. I mean, you know. And the trouble is, even if he was messing it up, you'd still think he's great. And at some point, he has to say, blow the bloody doors off.
They're all so good. And this is why they're in the movie, because...
they're very good.
And this is a benefit to it. You don't have to characterise them too much individually because you're only seeing them as the stars that they are.
That is true.
So when Robert Redford appears, he's going to be classic Robert Redford. So you can't remember the person who he's playing.
Yeah, true.
I know they're all real people, but now you're just going to see him as Robert Redford. So you're going to see Sundance going across the river in a boat, saving the day.
It is true.
And then you're going to see James Caan, like, driving around, yeah. Being really macho.
Yeah,
and then
about to get shot up in the toll booth.
Yeah, and yeah, Edward Fox, when he's giving his speech.
Edward Fox! Yes! You think he's going to go and shoot some lady and try and kill de Gaulle?
Which, The Day of the Jackal is one of the greatest movies ever. The greatest movie ever. It's so good! I wish that was historically accurate.
Ah! And pretend.
It's interesting to see that we remember them for the actors.
I think it's a really good point. That, and maybe that's actually a good thing, because this is a docudrama, and so maybe that...
So you recognise people, and you kind of roughly know where you are, and it helps... And there's one in each area.
Yeah.
There's a star in every location doing a different thing. So when you see Elliot Gould, you probably remember you're back by the bridge that exploded. Mm. When you see Michael Caine, you know you're with the tanks.
Yes.
So it does
help. The other thing that helps with that Michael Caine with tanks is it's usually all the tanks.
Yes, yes.
Sorry,
that is the, case.
I'd like to apologise.
So I want to ask you, what do you think the purpose of the film is?
Which is the question we promised we'd ask ourselves.
On a basic level, I think its number one aim is to create this epic depiction of the conflict as accurately as possible. The tagline was, "Out of the sky comes the screen's most incredible spectacle of men and war." The word spectacle features there, and I think that's what we're being given. They got all the correct and accurate equipment, planes, parachutes, everything was done as realistically as possible, and then filmed it for real. All those men coming out of the sky while they're up in the air filming them, this is Saving Private Ryan before Saving Private Ryan. They want to recreate this as best as possible. I would believe that the purpose is to show that the war, like never before, use film to its kind of greatest extent and really put us in the conflict. It doesn't, maybe it doesn't feel like that now because obviously so much time has passed.
I think it still does. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. But it's, but also, as you're probably going to go on to say, it's got also to be a little bit about an anti-war beat ourselves over the head, because otherwise, why would you choose that subject?
Yes.
You know, they chose The Longest Day for obvious reasons, because it was such a
success.
Incredibly important event in the Second World War. They could have chosen Alamein, they could have chosen, I don't know, the war in Italy, and there are films about those things. They chose this one, which is not a footnote in the history of the Second World War at all, but it isn't the big strategic thing.
Now, this is interesting because Cornelius Ryan felt that Market Garden was generally being omitted from history in our accounts of the Second World War because it was a failure.
Yeah.
We obviously won the war. We didn't want to worry about these errors that we had. And it was because it was the biggest like airborne operation ever carried out at this point. For it to be a colossal fail, let's just throw that out there now and then reevaluate if it was or not.
10,000 people's died, and 17,000 or something. Yeah.
It's still, you don't really want to worry too, like, talk about that now that we are, like, kind of past the war. So I believe part of his approach from writing the book was to kind of reevaluate everything that had happened and shed light on something which we were kind of ignoring, pushing under the rug. And also, obviously, as we will come up, Monty thought it was 90% a success.
Which is a remarkable statement,
and
isn't it?
I think because he was telling people it was a success, maybe people thought it was.
Yeah.
So this was to kind of show people that it wasn't, and this is kind of...
So it's good old honest, it's the good old honest, to goodness, historical revisionism, essentially, isn't it? Saying, look, actually, we need to understand this. Because it's not... The anti-war thing is not overt in it.
No.
It's not like, as we were saying, Charge the Light Brigade, where they set it up at the end. And you were talking about the end, where the way it ends was not like Charge the Light Brigade, where they set it up to make the officer class look like complete and utter idiots and morally vacuous idiots to that. They kind of walk away with regret when they're looking at the scene. They decide to call it off. I know that's not right at the end of the movie. And they all kind of look regretfully at each other and say a couple of things. Sean Connery doesn't take Dirk Bogarde to task right at the end. He just says, what do you think? And Dirk Bogarde says something very evasive and rather dishonest. Sean Connery doesn't lay into him. In a war movie, Sean Connery would have laid into him in moral indignation and stormed out of the building. Do you know what I mean? Doesn't do that.
And I think I would assume that's because they're trying to tell the story as it happened. Yeah. So there aren't going to be these big, like, grandstanding moments where people make these huge speeches that aren't plausible or they wouldn't have made at the time. Everything's going to be matter of fact and delivered the way that it took place.
And you reach the conclusion yourself, which in a way is a better way of doing it. In Charge the Light Brigade, you react against the end a little bit because you think, I'm sure they did not stand there and have that stand-up argument because they'd have had a bit more dignity and awareness to do that. Whereas in this, because it is much more realistic, it kind of grows on you that, oh, actually.
So at what point did you start to... did you think that it was an anti-war movement?
I kind of knew that it was... that this was about a failure of an operation, and therefore you wouldn't pick that unless you were going to tell everybody, actually.
Yeah, you know. And that was my thinking. I was like, there's no way you would attempt this movie if you don't have some anti-war, anti-establishment sentiment.
Yeah.
That has to be there. But, and this is where we'll guess we talk whether it's succeeded or not, I think quite a lot of the time, because it's just kind of trying to tell you the facts, it almost sits on the fence a bit. It's not overt in any of its message, and you have to kind of come up with your own thoughts.
It's not hard-hitting, certainly.
Sometimes it is. So, for example, that old lady will get mown down in the street.
Yes, there are a couple of... You're right.
Really shocking moment of violence. But then, Elliot Gould is chewing a cigar.
Yeah.
And you forget.
Yes.
And you're on to the next star-studded
scene. The saddest bit was... And it was all set up for pathos, wasn't it? It was the Dutch resistance guy. You know, they actually build the character of the relationship between father and son. It's a pretty cardboard cutout, but nonetheless, they build it up and it's a traditional relationship and therefore you invest in it. And so the son dying is quite a big moment. And that's much more of an anti-war moment, I thought, than the rest of it. That's very clear.
All the shots of the like bicycle tyres spinning and the fires. What's really interesting about the film on the whole is, A, because... The book collected, obviously, interviews from Germans, from the Dutch, from the resistance, from the civilians, from Americans, British, etc., from everyone, that you have this kind of really complete picture, which helps. And then the film clearly continues that by giving you everybody's viewpoints. I think it does a really good job of humanizing everyone involved. I think that the Germans are not faceless villains at all. They're just men in conflict.
Yeah.
And there's a really harrowing scene where that man dies in the tank on fire.
Yeah.
And I don't think you can watch that scene and think for one second that there is any hatred or anger in the filmmaker's eye in that footage. It's unless it is at war itself.
Yeah.
To me, that's a change from the movies in the 50s and the 60s. They were just bodies to be mown down.
Absolutely.
Or it wouldn't even show the death because it's kind of... You don't linger on it. But in this film, it does try to linger on the realities and the horrors of war. And they do like to throw the quotes out there about the amount of men who've died as well.
Yeah.
Just kind of give you statistics. I find it interesting that he obviously made Oh, What a Lovely War previously. So in 1969, he adapted that into a film, which is obviously about the futility of the First World War and the bumbling idiots in charge of everybody. Sending all these thousands of men off to die for no real purpose. And it's a very satirical, very anti-war statement. So I find it interesting that he's gone from that to this, because it makes me think about the anti-war angle, but it's clearly reduced. I do think it's worth discussing, as we've already come up with, how it views the leadership on the whole. Because that's where I feel like it really decides if it's an anti-war movie or not. So you've got Dirk Bogarde. If there is a villain of the piece, it is him.
It is him, yeah.
But Monty, who is the one he often refers to as being the one responsible, never appears in the film.
So if we move on to historical accuracy, which I guess is what we're talking about, that would be my main point. I mean, you'd know much more about the accuracy. By and large, I agree with you that from what everything I've read and what I've saw, it's difficult to get more accurate in a movie. I mean, you might have some specific points, but the biggest inaccuracy for me was the absence of the real villain of the piece, which was Monty, and indeed Eisenhower.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen Eisenhower mentioned anywhere, but he, of course, is the guy who makes the ultimate decision and is therefore ultimately responsible, and he approves a plan by Monty, which is incredibly ambitious and optimistic and ignores the experience of the Germans in Crete. So Eisenhower is also a villain of the piece, but possibly probably the biggest villain of the piece is Monty.
if every single person is in this movie, every general and field marshal and everybody involved, it is a little bit weird that Montgomery and Eisenhower aren't in it at all.
Yeah.
Particularly Montgomery, especially because he's mentioned directly a lot. Yeah.
But Monty is actually mentioned at least. It seems to me that Monty was, for the British, you know, the first time we won something. Because, you know, to be honest, just to be controversial here, if you look at our, you know, putting the senior service aside, British and English success at land battles, you know, you're talking Edward III, Duke of Marlborough, an Irishman called Duke of Wellington. Apart from that, I mean, I exaggerate, we'll get lots of letters. But, you know, and Monty won Alamein, and suddenly that gave everybody hope that actually we might, turning of the war kind of thing. So he's kind of an unbeatable figure. You're choosing the wrong word.
Isn't it interesting that the Germans think that he's an idiot, and they're really frightened of Patton?
Yes, that was really interesting.
Because, yes, that's what the Germans say, but... And it could just be historically accurate, but...
It's a big signal, I think.
Yeah, it's a big signal. You've got worry in the Allied ranks, and Montgomery isn't around, and they reference him a little bit, and they're questionable about his decisions, and you've got Gene Hackman, who's obviously opposing it a little bit, and they all kind of think they're going on a bit of a crazy mission. And then the Germans are like, if Patton's coming, we're all dead.
Yeah.
But if it's Montgomery, we don't have much to worry about.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
I would be very surprised if that's a historically accurate statement, and I think that's a big flag there in the movie that he's put there to compensate for the fact that he hasn't quite had the balls to put Monty in there as the villain.
Okay, so why do you think that Monty isn't in the film then?
Because, as I said, I think he's just too big a character for them to diss at this point.
Exactly, he's too heroic, too well-respected. Yeah. So do you think that then they are kind of... cop out a little bit and make Dirk Bogarde the villain?
I think so. That was my thought.
But do you think that they try to... Okay. Do you believe any of his answers at the end? When he kind of tries to abdicate some of the blame to
Montgomery? Understanding from what I read was that Browning did indeed say to Monty, look, I think this is one bridge too far, hence the title of the movie. And Monty dismisses his objection.
But is it not frustrating that he's not like that at the start of the film? At the beginning of the movie, he clearly sees the flaws and pursues it anyway.
But I think that's a good thing about the movie. I mean, I'm not a military man, so I don't know. But my understanding is that the potential for dispute in that situation is limited. The debate, the strategic discussion happens at an upper level. A decision is made, and once the decision is made, you have to go for it. And yes, you have to listen to objections. You might make objections operational, but you're not going to say, this is mad, we can't do this, because that's just not the way it works.
I do agree, but do you not think he's shown to be perhaps more of a coward?
Yes.
Especially in that scene when he realises they failed and they're like, you need to pull them out. And he's kind of quivering a little bit and has lost all of his confidence.
Yeah, he's hung out to dry as Browning, isn't he?
In the film. And so that's why, for me, when he says at the end, I always said we were going to go a bridge too far. Mm. It's so hollow.
It doesn't feel at all convincing.
And they've shown you earlier him rejecting the evidence about the Panzer Division.
Yeah.
And saying, well, we can't cancel this.
Yes.
And I do think that, happened.
Yeah.
But everybody clearly says his fault is really kind of minor in comparison to Montgomery's.
Yeah.
And the general entire structuring of the operation.
Yeah. Agreed.
But I just think that's interesting because if you're going to take Montgomery out, if you're going to not really put the blame on him, not finger the man, so to speak, then you're holding back and any real kind of anti-war sentiment that you want to kind of put out there, at the end, it's a little bit lost.
It's
slightly deflated.
I totally agree. Yeah, and they basically bottle it, don't they?
And then it's just, which is potentially fine if the ultimate purpose is just to be like a documentary.
But even then, it's not fine. I mean, what is the biggest historical inaccuracy in the movie, Wolf?
Well, you're going to tell me it's the fact that...
I would say it's the missing villain.
Yeah, I tried to find this out. I was trying to work out where Montgomery was during the conflict.
Mm.
Trying to work out where he's actually missing from the film. Because I can't work out where he is during this time period.
Mm.
As in, is he... where is he overseeing?
Yeah, is he overseeing it or is he...
Where is he stationed? Where is he watching?
Is he going fishing or what? Yeah.
And I was struggling to find that information because that would tell me just how much he is physically omitted.
Okay.
I do think it's possible that if he just wasn't in and around the area, that it's like a decision to not cut to him in a meeting room somewhere else. Maybe it's too many people, I don't know.
In the film, they could have put that key point where it's his decision, his plan.
So, overall, the accuracy is phenomenal. I mean, the whole purpose of the movie is to be accurate, and as such...
Were there any howlers? Or any, you know, concatenations or squidging to make it work?
There's a few things like, I'm going to pronounce it terribly, but Field Marshal Runsted, I think, was actually the one in charge on the Western Front.
Right.
It was just a different person.
Right.
Which seems slightly odd.
Yeah.
Considering everybody's mostly accurate. A few of the characters maybe have an incorrect name, but they're directly based on one individual. So as such, everybody is kind of playing all their roles, and everything seems to have happened the way it did. There might be a few issues to do with, like, colours of a few things, bits of equipment changes, but we're talking pretty minor.
We're talking Frank McClintock level.
And it was obviously full of war veterans and military advisors who'd all been in the conflict, who were there throughout, telling them how it happened and how it was done. And it's based off of a book that is all first-hand interviews and accounts of the entire event from all sides.
Right.
Because it's not just one perspective, because the Germans and the Allies and the civilians and the resistance are all incorporated into the responses. It gives you this completely rounded picture of how everybody viewed all the different scenarios and how everything took place. Did you notice that there is a German equivalent of Dirk Bogarde in the movie as well?
I got a bit confused between those two guys, actually. There was one of them who was kind of nice and, you know, allows them to move out of the house as POWs.
Yep.
And there's a nasty one who wants to kill everybody. But I didn't really know. But,
so, you know when they come to that guy's house and he's having dinner?
Yeah.
He's the one who's ultimately in charge.
Right.
And he's the one who says, he says that foolish thing where he's like, there's absolutely no possible way they want to take the bridge.
Yes.
Why would they do that? They're here for me. I'm the most important person here.
And then he legs it.
I've got to get away.
That's very funny. Yeah.
And he's the one who's drinking tea as well.
Right.
So,
tea is obviously a signifier.
I just thought that it was interesting that they level a similar amount of kind of pressure on
their
German high intelligence, where they're essentially saying that your kind of officers, the troops, everybody are innocent, and it's kind of people from the top have caused a lot of the problems.
Right.
And that your average German troop should not be...
Right, lions led by donkeys, good old... Okay, so, I mean, in summary, you loved it, is that right?
Okay, so in summary... The first time I saw the movie, I absolutely adored it.
Right.
In future times watching the movie, it's so long that I lose interest towards the end. I think the first hour is really good, especially this time. I get really excited with all the build-up, and I still really want to go to all those places and learn more about this.
Yeah.
But I just get completely lost during it. And one of those reasons I think I noticed this time is time frame. I have no comprehension of the time frame. There's a bit towards the end where Sean Connery's like, it was meant to be 2 days, we've been here for 9 days.
Yeah.
Do you ever comprehend that this is weeks long?
They do mention it a few times, but no, I don't have...
Does it feel like
all I feel is, the only impression I get is that this is taking too long. I don't know, doesn't feel as though it's taking 2 weeks.
And you can't comprehend how each of the groups time spans.
No.
So, you know how in Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan one, you kind of have these timescales for the three sections.
Although, can I just say that when I watched the movie, I had no idea.
Okay.
And it didn't affect my enjoyment one iota.
Fine. But what I mean is that's at least an approach where they're saying, like, this is how quickly the planes are covering this distance.
Yes.
This is how quickly the boats are. In this movie, I have no idea how far the tanks are getting, how close they are, how much time they need, and then how long the other people on Arnhem Bridge have been. I don't really get a sense of night and day changing, weeks passing.
No.
And as a result, especially with all the jumping around, it's hard to know where everybody is at kind of come the end of it.
Okay, but you still loved it. I thought it was very long, as you did. Afterwards, I came to love it a bit more because I realised that what you really needed to be was a bit of a history nerd. And once you got yourself into that mode of, I am being a history nerd here, and I'm worried about the size of the clips on their helmet and whether they've got the right ones or whether Michael Caine is wearing the right coloured scarf or not, then it got much more enjoying because I was looking at it in a different way. Rather than being one kind of entertainment, it was a documentary type. And then I liked it much more.
So if that's what you're looking for, it's really, really good.
Brilliant for that. Absolutely brilliant for that. So it began to get me to think, You know, we have this sort of vague quest in the ether that we're investigating, although really we just want to chat, but an excuse to watch some movies. But there's this idea that is historical accuracy an indicator of the quality of a history movie? Are we trying to do that?
Yes.
What's the relationship? So I'm beginning to think we could get towards a coefficient here. We could build an algorithm over the next few weeks, years, months, possibly decades. The level of historical accuracy is one variable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it might well be that there's a sweet spot where you can be historically accurate enough, but if you're too historically accurate, it gets dull. And if you're not, if you're really unhistorically accurate, inaccurate, like, let me think, Braveheart, then you lose everybody because everybody gets too annoyed.
Oh, okay, but you should also admit that with that one, you don't lose everybody because it's still universally...
I've got another dimension. Not anymore, it isn't.
Okay.
We're chipping away. Slowly, we're chipping away. But I agree, there is another coefficient, which is the eye of the beholder dimension.
Okay.
So if I am completely ignorant about that period, then historical accuracies are not going to annoy me because I'm not going to spot them.
Yeah.
If I am a scholar of some renown in that period, I'm going to find it unwatchable because I'm going to say, hang on, no. Oh, no. Oh, come on. Oh, you must be what? You know what I mean?
Yep.
So there's another dimension in this algorithm, which is about the level of knowledge of the watcher. And then there's another angle, which is the quality of the cast, the quality of the film, the script writing, all the good old normal things about, you know, the quality of the film, is it well put together? Put all that together, and I think we could build an algorithm, plug in some numbers, and come up with an answer, which is probably going to be 42.
Okay, so what you're saying is, in terms of this film, the film is so historically accurate. Are we saying a 9?
That it gets... A 9 sounds like a good mark.
Because
we just scored it. Any messing about. We just scored it.
Yep.
Didn't have any bait.
So we're saying a 9.
Okay. You didn't shout at me.
So what you're saying is, if it's really historically accurate, the chances of it being also high in the film category are going to reduce.
Yeah.
So where are you putting it as a film?
I'm going to go 6.
Oh, you really want to go as far as low down as 6?
Maybe 7. You could probably persuade me into 7.
Okay. Well, let's go 7 because I was going to go towards an 8.
Right. Okay.
But I do understand that if you're not interested in, like...
Was really war, quite bored.
I know, but if you're really interested in, like, war history...
Yes.
I can really see you push right up the scale. But if you're not, you go down.
Indeed.
So 7 makes sense.
Okay.
So what you're saying is, if you had known this was going to be a 9 or 10 in accuracy in advance, you would have predicted perhaps a 6 or 7 in entertainment.
Indeed. So what I'm saying is, if they'd taken an hour out, if we'd seen a little bit less of Robert Redford's Jaws, if we'd taken Ryan out of it, honestly, then maybe it would have been a better film. If you'd taken down 2 hours, actually, maybe I'd have been gripped.
And maybe more shouting from Sean Connery at the end?
Bit more shouting from, Sean. Bit more shouting from Sean would have been good. Oh, it would be good, wouldn't it? And why didn't Michael
say,
blow
the tea drinking
the bloody doors off? Why didn't he say that? I mean, it was
perfect. He was in a tank.
He had a big gun. Blow the bloody doors off.
I don't know.
Anyway, you see my point? We can work on that algorithm.
So I think what we need to do now is we need to propose, or I need to propose to you, films that you have not seen.
Yeah.
And then you need to kind of, we predict with the algorithm where you think it will rank, and then see what you think afterwards.
I think we need to work out the algorithm, though.
Okay.
I think we've got a lot more work. And I think we need somebody with a brain. We need somebody to help us. Because I haven't got a mathematical brain. I can't work.
Between the two of us, we can't do anything. So let's bring in a third party.
Okay, so are we done?
I think we are. I think just something to throw out there kind of as the outcome of all of this, because we haven't really talked about how much it is as a failure. I think it's really interesting to note that the Netherlands suffered greatly.
Right.
As a result of this operation.
Right, it doesn't come out in the film. It does a bit, but what you mean subsequently?
Their railway lines were cut off by the Germans because they'd used them to help the Allies. And then they starved the population horrifically. Perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people died from starvation in the Netherlands.
Right.
Now, I know that, and it's shown a lot in the movies, the cheering and support for the troops. I do think a lot of people recognise the effort, and a lot of people, some people were rescued by them. It is interesting to think that they were living, I know it's occupied, but relatively safely and had been for a while. After this invasion, a lot of them are killed. Which I think that's an interesting point to put out there. And that Monty tried to get the Polish division moved because he blamed them directly for the failings and said they didn't try hard enough, they weren't in on it.
Yeah.
And that he tried to get rid of them and shift them off to another.
And that's part of that thing I was talking at the beginning of. It's pretty clear that there's an anti-foreigner thing. Who can we blame? Well, the Poles.
Yeah, and then they put that in right from the beginning of the movie and how they all treat Gene Hackman throughout the film, which is partly maybe why he doesn't have a voice. Maybe he knows. But I think that's worth, as we remember Monty and he's not shown in the film, it's worth pointing out that if we think he's at fault for this, he was kind of a bit of an arse about it afterwards as well, which is interesting when we remember him.
Indeed.
Anything else you want to add?
I think that's it. That's been very interesting. I enjoyed the film more because we were having discussion than we would have done if we weren't.
Good.
So, you know, History of Technicolor has achieved something for me personally.
And when was the last time you saw this film?
Decades.
Okay, so it was almost completely fresh to you?
Yeah, I remember bits of it. I'd clearly watched it when I was a lad, but, you know, that's
interesting.
A long time ago. All right. Very good. Thank you very much, everybody. Before we go, we'll be inserting the roundup from the last episode, which is The Madness of King George, here.
Hello, everyone, including Jason, of course, and welcome to the roundup of our full and frank exchange of views about The Madness of King George, which was something of a love-in, as it happens. This film has set a new high of love. 82% of you, yes, that's 82% of you, who watched it, loved it. Not just liked it, not just thought it was okay, but loved it. I commend you all for the quality of your taste. But then, of course, we know that you've got great taste because you're listening to this podcast. Ha ha. The previous best, actually, had been Amadeus at only 65%. So I can only ask, will Madness ever be equaled? So why did you love it all so much? Well, it was funny. Nicole remembers laughing out loud at the movie. Tim then reminded us that the acting is as impeccable as the writing. Steve did a mic drop for Nigel Hawthorne, which I know is a good thing. Eleanor gave a shout out for Helen Mirren, and of course we all shout out for Helen Mirren. And Alan pointed out that Alan Bennett is an Oxford-trained historian and almost became a medievalist don. So, great writing, funny, historically accurate, brilliantly acted. So that's all right then. The other angle actually was the point that Kathleen made, that the film humanised George III from his reputation as a tyrant, and there was general agreement to that from Mimi, Jennifer, Juan and others. George III would like you all to know that he's very pleased. Luke then reminded us of the story that the film's original title had originally included George III, but they'd taken it out because they worried people wouldn't go because they'd think it was a sequel to George I, George II, which I can report sadly is apocryphal, which is a tragedy because it's far too good a gag not to be true. Sadly, a better gag than my putting the boot in thing, which William was very forgiving about. Thank you, William, for pointing out that it's my podcast and I can cry or crack rubbish gags if I want to. Though Wolf might want to comment on that one. Anyway, it was great. Tickety-donk, everyone, and I hope you enjoy Bridge every bit as much.
Welcome back from that, and that's it. So please come onto the Facebook site. The debate is almost as much fun as us doing this. So come on and tell us what you think. Give us your views.
Yeah. If you have any feedback for us, put it out there and we will listen.
Yes.
Or not.
Constructive feedback is always good. Great. Fantastic. All right. See you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you. Bye.
Are you not entertained?